Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This is the Tudors Dynasty Podcast. And now, Ask the Expert with Steph.
Hello, and welcome back to Ask the Expert with the Tudors Dynasty Podcast. I'm your host, Steph Storer, and joining me today is the wonderfully creative and lovely author and historian, Jan Marie Knight. Thank you for joining us, Jan.
Thank you for asking me.
Well, today's topic is a really fascinating one because it always creates so much interest. And that topic, of course, is the Tudor socialite. Hearing about the daily lives of those at court, or even the wealthy, the nobility not at court, is quite captivating to think about, as it's just so drastically different than what we're used to. When I hear the word socialite, unfortunately, it's hard to take it out of like a modern context and not picture, you know, a Kardashian or a Hadid or something. And that's not what we mean here. So, Jan, why don't you give us your definition of what a socialite was back then in the Tudor era?
Well, I imagined the socialite for the book was a woman courtier, not necessarily important personage, but someone close enough to have the right connections and friends to hear all the gossip, be involved in or hear about events, kind of knowing the right people, and above all, keeping your eyes and ears open, you know, and really, you could kind of say all the above stairs sort of people. And also, I have to say, you know, I read the letters and journals by the people of the time, and it made everything so immediate to such an extent that one of the letter writers died in mid-correspondence. And I had to stop reading because I felt so sad. I almost had to go away and mourn him. And looking at the contemporary journals like Hawes Chronicle, help me imagine what I was seeing and feeling and hearing, or even overhearing, actually, smelling, to convey a whole sense of being there and trying to write down those impressions so that people reading the book would feel the same way.
I love that. Thank you. It's such a great connection that you have then with your subject.
I try.
So how would you? Yeah, of course. And that's how we know you're a great writer, right?
Oh, hey, it's Rebecca here. I'm sorry to interrupt the show. I just want to quick do a shout out to all of my patrons. And if you love the show, you want to hear more of it, want to show your support, please consider becoming a patron on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/tutorsdynasty. Click become a patron to find out more info. We had some cool stuff coming up. So let's get back to the show.
So how would one become a socialite at the time? Were they all people at court? Or could you work your way up? Or how did you become a socialite?
Well, being noble or upper gentry, you had access to the court either because you were a royal servant or you were a servant or a royal servant. And if you were right in the midst, you could gain access to much of what was happening. And another surprise, actually, from reading the letters, although this doesn't quite apply, was how much generally people knew about what was going on. Not the secret machinations and the secret policies, but the day-to-day activities. As people wrote home to their families, I mean, think of the Paston letters, for instance, and others. You can find these online. Anybody can to read them. So generally, people even outside the court were quite well informed. So you didn't have to be at court to write diary entries. But however, generally, a socialite means someone who wishes to be within the fashionable set, which is, of course, in Tudor times, the court and the government. and it covers both men or women. And some of those gossips were as much men as women. The letters by ambassadors convey an awful lot of gossip from one court to the other courts. And also they wrote letters to their personal friends, so you get the personal touches as well. And an example would be the legate Campeggio, who had come to hear the case between Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon. He actually writes to a friend with a big moan about the English summer weather. And he's telling this person in Rome he's shivering in front of a fire in June. Well, I can say not much changes. It's 1st of June today and the weather's much the same. And I mean, or my favourite, a Mr. Underhill, he's asked to be a server at Queen Mary Tudor's wedding to Prince Philip of Spain, who obviously becomes Philip II. And he sends a venison pasty to his wife for her and their friends to enjoy. So all these little touches that, you know, got to read and ponder on.
So as far as these nobles or the gentry that are at court, there are certain, I guess, bits of etiquette that one must follow when you are in these social circles. If you had worked your way up and you weren't necessarily born into the circles and therefore taught things from birth, who would teach you how to behave in these social circles if you didn't already know? Were there, I mean, saying, you know, an etiquette teacher sounds silly, but
well,
who would teach you?
Almost you're right with that. When it came to the nobles and perhaps the higher gentry, they were taught at home or they were sent out to other houses where they would meet with people of their own age, and they would be taught manners, how to eat and drink. They would learn to dance and ride and hunt. They would be given lessons in music as well as foreign languages. And add to that, women would learn cooking and herb craft for making medicines. Both would learn how to manage estates and understand accounts. So there would be such an opportunity to learn from being emulating your elders, mixing with your peers, so there'd be a certain amount of perhaps competition, and tutors were brought in. So everything that was considered necessary for you to play your part in society, they'd be engaged for them. And sometimes even a personal appearance would play a part. I mean, Henry VII only wanted ladies who were pretty to wait on Catherine of Aragon when she came to England to marry Prince Arthur. And then further down the scale, there were schools of different types that were set up by various people, which included monarchs and priests. Those clever enough would go on to university, either here or abroad. People interested in law would go to Paris, those in the church perhaps to Italy. But everyone at the time were conscious of rank and birth, but that doesn't mean those of low birth couldn't move up the social scale. And the classic example, of course, is Cardinal Wolsey, who begins, as they say, a butcher's son. He impresses Henry VII with his quick thinking and service, and then his son, Henry VIII, and moved up to be pretty much the second highest person in the land.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
That's actually exactly who I was thinking of when I was asking that question.
I think it's the one we all think of, and Cromwell, of course, is next.
Right. So it was possible, but they had to work pretty hard to get there.
Yes.
So once you are in the court, or you have made it to these circles, what was kind of a day in the life of a Tudor socialite? I know you had mentioned the hunting or riding, dancing, things like that. But how did a typical day go? And actually, if you are able to and want to tell us maybe a man and a woman, that would be a great way to give us kind of an all-encompassing view of their day.
Much of what we know we glean from the account books, which show how people within the households were paid, what food they were given, what lodgings they were given. And that was the same whether you were upper or lower orders, and it was set by lords of the household. So all the houses, including royal ones, operated under what would be called a set of ordinances. Now, in Henry VIII's time, there was a book found of detailed rules called the Eltham Ordinances. This was supposed to keep good order in his household, keep waste to a minimum, and it was signed off by the king, so they could consult it regularly. And if I can explain the sort of general outline first. Basically, there'd be a main building or great hall or outer chamber used for public life, and usually where upper servants would sleep. There would be a presence chamber for conducting private business, and there would be a private chamber or privy chamber for the more intimate parts of life with close friends and relatives. And the king and queen have separate apartments and offices. A comptroller they would each have for accounting and checking provisions and supplies. So the steward looked after the hall and servants, and he oversaw all the departments to ensure an efficient household, and a chamberlain the other areas, and anything pertaining to the monarch's comfort and his bedroom. And the queen, of course, had her own. So everyone has a position with clearly delineated duties to be formed, which attach to that position, where this was the way everything was made to run smoothly. This meant whatever estate or degree you were, it would dictate where you were lodged or not, how much provisions you would obtain in coal and candles, food, how much bread, meat you would receive, and even which privy, toilet, you were allowed to use, plus the hours you were engaged for and how much time you were allowed off. And if you broke the rules, you were fired. And the Eltham ordinances show that gentlemen of Henry VIII's privy chamber were expected to work 6 weeks on and 6 weeks off, although this could vary. And then, of course, the court moved around pretty regularly. So smooth functioning was an essential. This meant palaces could be aired, provisions would not be completely used up in one area. And, of course, it gave the monarchs a chance to be seen by the people and, where necessary, dispense justice. Back to the positions, to give an instance, a groom of the wardrobe would hang tapestries in the chambers, set up the bed hangings with mattresses, coverings, bolsters, pillows, put down the carpets, all these things kept in a great store cupboard called a wardrobe. And of course, the robes and jewels were kept safe in the wardrobe of the robes. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of people involved, anything between 200 in a normal household to 1,000 in the royal household. But once duties were over, then it was time to go and enjoy yourself. Then it was tennis and shooting at the Bart's bowls, indoors and out. That would be mainly for the men, while the ladies watched. For the ladies, it would be conversation, needlework and embroidery. For both, there would be playing cards or board games such as Fox and Geese. They'd play musical instruments and compose songs and poetry. Some would write letters. There were three groups of women in the Queen's household. There were ladies of the Privy Chamber, married and of high rank. They attended to her washing, her dressing, serving at table. She had chambers who would deal with cleaning her chambers and the beds and all the other sorts of tasks. And then there were maids of honour that were unmarried up to 16 years of age. And they attended her in public or in private to entertain her with singing, dancing or reading. And like the men, obeyed the household regulations with given duties.
Now, when we are going to shift our focus a little bit, actually now to mealtime, because we actually got a lot of questions from our listeners this go around about the dinner table. Or, I mean, I guess it could be a breakfast or a lunch, you know, whatever meal, just sitting around the table, there are a lot of rules. So one of the things that our listeners were wondering was who sits at what table and where? Are there rules to who gets to sit beside whom?
Oh yes. The whole of Tudor society is governed by rules. Dinner was usually about midday, but if there were a lot of people lodged, especially at court, it would be arranged in sittings. So a first sitting might be earlier. Once the steward was alerted that the food was ready to be served, and this would be, you know, whatever dining chamber was being used, whether a great hall or just a very large room, They would set up trestle tables and benches to sit at the tables. And they'd be covered with linen tablecloths. I mean, people often are surprised, but yes, tablecloths and napkins were de rigueur, you should say. Usually the long tables ran down each side of the room, and then a table would be put on the day, I can never remember how it's pronounced, die on the platform. The high table, in fact, that's where it really sort of comes from. And that would be above the other tables and also always be furthest from the entrance. Marshals then kept an eye on who entered the room, so that only those entitled to eat in the hall were allowed in, and they were told where they would sit, so that the whole thing of precedence and rank and title position was totally known by the marshals, and they would place the people where they needed to go. Then the people called sewers or servers would serve at the tables, and the marshals would tell them which dishes would go to whom, and the amount of dishes would vary according to rank. There were two main courses to each sitting, and it comprised a variety of dishes so that people could choose from quite a range. And they were generally served to four or six people at one time, and these were called messes. So that's where we get the term mess from. And then they would take the food and serve it to their own plates. They were also allocated a drink allowance, either beer or wine, and that differed depending on the person's rank. Diners sort of used their own knives and spoons, and they also used their fingers. So bowls of water, usually rose water with napkins, were always provided. And everyone ate in hall. It would designate this, whether it was a room that was a dining chamber or if there were more chambers used because there was more people. And unless they were invited to the privy chamber to eat, that is where everybody ate. And this was to keep good order. So the heads of departments will be keeping an eye on everyone. And there were regulations similarly with regard to the ladies of the court. And that also defined what board and provision they would be allowed. And they were ranked as duchesses, countesses, baroness and knights' wives. It sometimes depended on whether their husbands were at court. Ladies of the Queen's household were allowed rooms and stabling and their own servants otherwise. Obviously, at times of festivals, there'd be a lot more pomp and ceremony, such as food being served by announcement of trumpets. They might be served dressed. The servers might be dressed in costumes. So there were lots of differences as well. That was the main table etiquette.
I just want you to hold on to put a pin right in that festival one, because I do have a question about that. But one more thing about the ladies. I know that we had said the women who attend to the queen are divided into, you know, those that are married and those that are unmarried. Was there a similar ranking for the men? Did it matter if the men were married or not? Or is that only contributed to the title of the ladies?
Well, the men's side of it didn't seem to matter too much whether they were married or unmarried. There wasn't the same defining in that sense.
What were the different titles that they could hold?
Oh, they would be obviously dukes, earls, marquises, barons, and then you get your gentry, which would be the knights. And sometimes the important landowners.
And then as far as when they would tend to the king, would they all be considered groomsmen?
No, there were different functions. So you would get grooms of the chamber, you get grooms of the privy stall, which is literally attending the monarch in his very, very private moments. And the personal attendants would be the most early risers of the upper class servant, shall we say, because obviously you would get the kitchen staff in the lower ranks being quite early. And then you would get the dressers, you would get a barber. They had a lot more roles, really, than the women did. There weren't so many jobs for the women to do, although women did, in fact, act as laundresses and things like that.
Now, if you were noble or if you had money, it's fair to say then that even if you're not the king or queen, you might have servants in your home as well. So do you think that it was more prestigious to be a lower ranked servant at court to the king or queen, or a very highly ranked servant to another rich person or another, you know, highly ranked person, not that was not a king or queen?
If you were ambitious, your aim was to go as high as you could. And as high as you could was the royal court, or to be of standing service in one of the palaces that would belong to the royal family. So in actual fact, you would rather be perhaps not an even very well-paid servant at court, because that was where you got your prestige. That was where you got your opportunities to better yourself in whichever way you wanted to go forward.
Interesting. So it does make a big difference then.
Yeah.
To be at the royal court versus, you know, a highly ranked servant, I guess, in someone else's home.
Well, it would seem so. I don't think when it comes to working, things have changed awfully much. I think depends on what your personal aim is. Some people might like to be a really highly paid servant in a lesser household because it suits them for whatever reason it does. And I think we're all the same in that way nowadays. Some people are more ambitious than others. Some people would rather have a comfortable job in a position of trust with people that they've perhaps grown up with.
That's a great point. It's definitely not altogether different. All right. Well, let's go back to the festivals and the celebrations that you had started to mention before, but then we got a little sidetracked. And so we're going to circle back to that now. What are some important things that some of these people in the Tudor socialite world would celebrate? And actually, one of our listeners had written in asking if people had birthday parties. Is that something that they celebrated back then?
Not exactly. They're not celebrated in the way we do now. In fact, there's not much evidence to show birthdays were taken much notice of, because some people, of course, were not totally aware of their dates of birth. And sometimes we only know them from a note in a Bible or a journal. Although there is a possibility Mary Queen of Scots held a ball on her 20th and 21st birthdays. It certainly upset Knox anyway. But they were aware of their ages. On Maundy Thursday, Henry VIII washed the feet of poor men whose number equaled his age, and he gave them a red purse with a like number of pennies. The people knew the ages of their monarchs, because when Queen Elizabeth, Henry VII's wife, died in childbirth, it was on her birthday, her 37th birthday, and on her funeral progress, on the way to being buried, there were 37 maids dressed in white linen with white and green wreaths on their heads. And they held a burning wax taper, and there was 37 for each year of Elizabeth's life. Saints' days and feast days were quite numerous. Many had specific traditions and foods that went with them. And it might surprise people to know that they had 60 holy days, or shall we say holidays, in a year, and the people were forbidden.
Did you say 60?
60, yes. 60. Obviously, their life was harder than ours, so they probably needed them. But on those days, people were forbidden to work or even to play games or to travel, because they were obliged to attend Mass or church, depending on how we went through the Reformation. Basic festivals, you could start with Candlemas, which was the 2nd of February, and was also called the Feast of the Purification of the Virgin Mary. And the popular name, Candlemas, presents the candlelit processions which they made on that day. Easter, of course, always a biggie. That started with Shrove Tuesday, which was also called Fat Tuesday, because you had to eat cheeses, milk and bacon and anything else you needed to eat before it went off. And you had to eat it before sundown because it started the 40-day fasting for Lent. Then, of course, Easter week began with Palm Sunday, and leaves were brought into the church in memory of the procession into Jerusalem. I think there would be more like willow leaves and yew leaves, because obviously we don't have palms. On Maundy Thursday, candles were extinguished to symbolise the coming darkness of the crucifixion on Good Friday. And of course, Easter Sunday was considered the most important holy day, and all work stopped. Then you had Midsummer's Eve. That was the feast of St. John the Baptist. And the popular activities were huge bonfires. They stayed up the whole night, which was also called a watch. They put parades on, military displays. There'd be food set out with fruits and vegetables and herbs. Michaelmas was a time in September to sow wheat and brew ales and start preparing for winter. All Souls Day, 1st of November, that was the time for praying and thinking of those who died, and masses were said to shorten their length of time in purgatory, because Roman Catholics at that time believed, well, I don't know if they still do actually, believed everyone had to spend some time after death there. Martin Mass heralded the beginning of Advent, the four-week period before Christmas, and that was so you could do penance and fasting for 3 days a week, and you weren't allowed to eat certain foods such as meat, cheese and eggs. And then celebration with three Masses began on Christmas Day. Much like today, the 12 days of Christmas was a time of rest and joy, except for tending animals. That was the one thing you were allowed. Spinning was banned. Women were not allowed. And you rested up then until work on the land began again around Plough Monday, which was the first Monday after Twelfth Night or 6th of January. Leaving the court for the moment, you'd see villages and towns, neighbours would visit each other, would enjoy a minced pie, would you believe? Well, that was made of dried fruits and spices such as mace, cloves and saffron, and funnily enough, chopped mutton. So these ingredients, there were supposed to be 13 to represent Christ and his disciples, and the mutton was to remember the shepherds by, and they were often shaped like cribs. Carols were popular. The earliest recorded book of carols is one by Wynkyn de Worde in 1521, and homes were decorated on Christmas Eve with greenery such as holly, ivy and laurel, and anything else they wanted to put up. Now, as for food, the traditional Christmas dinner for nobles and gentry used to be a swan or a goose. And in the nobler households and royal circles, they would also add venison, roasted peacock and wild boar. I think we've all heard about the boar's head served on a platter. Turkeys came to England in 1523 and they became really popular. And a Tudor Christmas pie was developed, especially in royal circles, because I mean, it was a really expensive dish. We're talking turkey stuffed with goose, stuffed with a chicken, stuffed with partridge, and then a pigeon, all put in a pastry case, which they called a coffin. And it was served with small pies made to look like small cabbages. In the court, up to 24 courses would be served. Specifically on the three saints' days, which would be Christmas Day, New Year's Day and Twelfth Night. Leftover food was given to the poor. On Twelfth Night, there was a fruit cake, which would house a dried bean or a coin, and whoever found it could act as king or queen for the evening. But the other important part of the celebrations was New Year's Day, which is when gifts were exchanged. And Henry had a bill recorded with all the gifts. In 1528, he gave Anne Boleyn two bracelets set with 10 diamonds and 8 pearls. In 1534, Anne gave Henry a diamond-encrusted fountain which had water flowing from the breasts of three naked nymphs into a bowl decorated with rubies and pearls. Some of the New Year's gifts received by Queen Elizabeth were remarkable. In 1572, she was given a white rose with a spider with a lozenge diamond on its back and underneath a bee with two diamonds. And from Robert Dudley, the Earl of Leicester, she got a gold bracelet with a clock in its clasp, which was decorated with rubies. And of course, sometimes they use gifts in other ways. For in 1580, Sir Philip Sidney angered the Queen and only got back into her favour by presenting her with a jewelled whip to show his subjection, and he was forgiven.
It really sounds like my husband is slacking in the gift department. I'm listening to all these things and I'm like, this is crazy. Do we know where any of those gifts are now?
Some were recorded in Henry's inventory, and then they did pass the jewels on, but a lot of them got melted down and reutilized. So some do and some don't.
Oh, that is such a shame.
It is.
That's such a shame.
Yeah. You can thank Cromwell, I'm afraid, Oliver Cromwell, for some of the stuff that got lost when it came to some of the royal jewellery.
We can blame him for a few things over the course of... Well, okay, so let's now, I guess, turn to... I could listen to the gifts. And stuff. I think the holidays and the gifts is my favorite part of our conversation, but well, I do have more questions here.
just let me say then that... If anybody wants to go onto the London University British History site, which is british-history.ac.uk, you can look up some of these things, and they have the lists of showing what presents were given and received. And it includes what, you know, when Henry VIII refused Catherine of Aragon's present and sent it back. And it shows what he gave out to other people and what other people gave him. So he got presents of shirts with embroidery on the collars. He got daggers. He got chess sets. You name it, he got it. It's quite interesting.
In addition to being obviously expensive and worth a lot and lavish and whatever, they all sound so clever.
Yes.
Like these gifts are not, you know, things that you would see every day. It's not just, you know, a very expensive bracelet that has a lot of jewels on it. I mean, they all kind of mean something or depict a story. It's very interesting.
And sometimes, of course, they made the things. So they would write books and have them decorated. Catherine of Aragon was well known for making his shirts, and she would make special embroidery on them, and they would then be gifts. People made him caps. There was so many things, and it's really well worth having a look up.
Yeah, it really is. So we'll give you a chance actually at the end. We'll talk about that website again, just so everybody can take a look at it. But for now, let's talk about their clothing. What was the difference in what someone, what a Tudor socialite might wear as compared to somebody who didn't have the kind of money that they had?
All through the various reigns, all through the ages, even from the sort of Plantagenet times and Tudor times and the Stuart times, there were what were called sumptuary laws or acts of apparel. And it meant people differing ranks were told what colours and materials they could wear and how they should dress. Sometimes ignored, and sometimes they got arrested. In general, it's a hard one to kind of call at times, because it crept in amongst the tiers of society. But in general, at the time we're talking, only the monarch and his immediate family could wear cloth of gold and purple. And he wore the richest cloth. I mean, he wore, and his family could wear the finest silk, the finest taffeta, satin and velvet. And he liked ostrich feathers to decorate his hats and caps. Courtiers were allowed velvet, and they were allowed silk and linen, and could wear a certain amount of decoration. The deeper the colour, the more expense people thought had been paid out for them, because they were regarded as more expensive. The ladies wore damask velvet and satins, and their own servants would wear liveries of whatever colours they chose, their mistress's colours, a lot of russet actually, and lower ranks dressed in practical wool with fewer ornaments. The women in particular wore layers of clothing. There would be a white linen shift, or what we would call a chemise, next to the skin. Then a petticoat went over, which is often called scarlet because that's the colour it was. They put a sleeveless kirtle over that with a stiffened bodice. And then there'd be an outer gown and a stomacher, which I think you can realise is the little thing they wore around. There were woolen stockings, which must have been absolutely hell on earth to wear. And obviously would have a girdle belt so that they could put a little rosary to it, or a little book, or whatever, bit of jewellery. And of course they had to wear a headdress, whether it was just a linen cap for the lower orders or a more decorative one by more the people up the higher ranks over the social classes. I actually think it's really hard to describe the clothes. When I was describing them in The Tudor Socialite, I did really rely a lot on what I found in the journals. And sometimes it was very frustrating because they were written by men or they were written by priests. And they weren't always very descriptive. So I found the best way of really seeing what was going on was looking at portraits, basically. And you can find a lot of those now on the internet. Some really good portraits in the English National Portrait Gallery. That they can be accessed, actually, so people can always look them up. And also, funnily enough, in the Netherlands Museum, a Rijksmuseum. So that's kind of where I would look it up in a way, so that I could describe what I was writing about. And the other thing I did, we have some local museums around here, and I went to one, and I wanted to know what cloth of gold was like. I mean, after all, it's not a material we're really used to, is it? And I was very lucky, went to a house where Catherine Parr was mistress of at Gainsborough. And they have a little display there with clothes that have been made as copies of what Henry VIII and Catherine Howard wore. And I have to say that cloth of gold is quite heavy. And it made me understand how they could walk with the long skirts, because they could literally put it with a weight and it would just stay there, which enabled them to walk quite easily.
Oh, my goodness.
But I was amazed. I always thought it was a softer material, and it isn't. It's actually quite a hard material. But then
nothing sounds comfortable. Nothing sounds, I mean, whether you were poor and you were just wearing, you know, a wool gown or something, all the way up to wearing the cloth of gold, nothing sounds, you know, as comfortable as they didn't have loungewear. They didn't have the luxury of just putting on, you know, whatever, just to hang out in, right? Because what you wore had to reflect who you are.
Not just that either. The clothes weren't easily cleaned, so you would wear them.
Sure, right.
The reason they would wear the linen shifts were those were the things that would easily be changed, but your overgown would probably be worn a few times, and that's why they would hang them up. I suppose the way people still do with their clothes if they can't exactly dry. Well, they kind of had a dry cleaning method, you could say.
Right. How many linen shifts would one own if you were a Tudor socialite?
Well, they would own as many as they needed. If you were lower down, you'd probably only have the one.
So would they, do you think that they would have, because obviously I'm envisioning, you know, the queens and the upper kind of circles as having closets filled with the overdresses. But even their, you know, would they have?
Well, they actually
tons of the linen shifts as well, or is that just something they have a couple and interchange them and wash them? And
they would have enough linen and they would be washed. That's why they would have the laundresses. The interesting thing about women's clothing and I suppose the men's clothing, but I've not really looked as much at them, to be fair, is the fact that everything was sort of add-ons. You had sleeves that you would lace onto the dress. If you think about it, it was all made up of parts, which made life easier for cleaning and making yourself look different every time you wore something.
Oh, yeah, you can mix and match the pieces of your outfit.
Everything was mixed and matched, actually, yes. So it's quite interesting.
How interesting. And one last question about the headpieces. I know you said there wasn't much, and thanks to the guys who kept the records, there wasn't a lot of detail. But what were the rules about what you had to wear on your head, or how much hair had to be covered, or what were the rules about headpieces?
I have to be honest, I don't actually know.
I don't know is always a good answer. That's totally acceptable.
It's not something I kind of just noted that people would, you know, the women would. Married women obviously had to keep their hair covered. But I have to be honest, no, it was not something I kind of explored too much. I was too busy trying to work out the other things, I think. The maids, they didn't have to cover their heads, but I actually, do you know, you've made me wonder now. I'm going to have to look it up and find out.
That's fine. We always love a cliffhanger. We'll talk about that next time, right? Now, one of our final questions from our listeners was about what here in America, we call it vacation. I guess you guys call it a holiday, but
yeah.
at the time, they mentioned it being referred to as summer progress or things like that. Where did the Tudor socialite go when they wanted to get away, and how much time were they given? And even then, did they mingle with commoners when they went away because they left court? Or tell us about what that kind of looked like for them.
Right. Well, the summer progress was a mix of things, really. Being a socialite, you wanted to stay with the court, so you really wanted to be well in so that the king would say, oh, yeah, you can come along. more before Henry VII's time, they were used to dispense justice as a way of, you know, holding local courts. But the progress as we kind of know it in Tudor times started really with Henry VII. When he beat Richard III at Bosworth, he made a progress in 1486, and this was to show himself to the people so they knew who he was. And of course, the northern counties were a bit problematical at the time for him because they were rather for Richard, not him. And so he went on a progress to gain their homage and to gauge loyalty. And then it sort of became something that he would do. They would go and have some leisure time. So he would like go to Kenilworth, and he built tennis courts there. So he was very keen on tennis. By Henry VIII's time, it is more like a holiday because he indulged with a few courtiers in hawking and hunting. And you know, he just wanted to be with his closer friends. And the progresses were also, so they would be seen by commoners and people who lived outside of the court. They wanted to make their presence known. And also the privy expense accounts, they've got multiple entries of gifts that are given to them by common people and the rewards they got for it. Strawberries were brought to Anne Boleyn on one of the rides out with Henry. He got cheeses and salad stuff. His father on a progress gives 2 shillings to a woman that sings with a fiddle. He does 4 shillings to a May game that he sees. Progresses were also discreet ways of checking out the towns, the ports, the fortresses, the houses of nobles. And the other part of the progress was to give the standing servants that were left behind a chance to air and clean the lodgings and the toilets and, all the rooms. And then, of course, out of all the monarchs, Queen Elizabeth I was very much a people's princess. And I would say out of them all, she was the ruler with the most common touch. When she attended her first parliament, the populace shouted for God save and maintain thee. And she stopped and smiled at them and gave them thanks, and they loved it. And if they knew which way she was coming back from her progress, they would wait hours to see her to show their affection. And an example of a visit she makes to a town come port, she visits Sandwich, and the whole town turn out and they put on an entertainment for her. And on the first day, it's men displaying martial skills. The second day, their wives throw her a banquet, and they put 160 dishes on a table 28 foot long. And she sampled them and made comments on them and asked for some to be saved for her so she could have them later at her lodgings. And the day she actually leaves, she watches the children give a display of spinning skills. So she did use her progresses to communicate with people at all levels of society. And she would have dinner in one place and supper in another, and not necessarily in a big house. And she used them to evaluate what was happening in local economies. And then, of course, displays of fighting and swordplay using gunpowder and cannon in mock battles was a very useful and covert way of ensuring local people were trained in martial skills. Rather useful when she was being threatened with an armada coming her way.
Well, I think that really covers a lot about the Tudor socialites at this point. And anything else that our listeners would like to hear about or have any more questions about, I think that you have a book that we can tell them about to get the rest of it, right?
Oh, yes. Yes. I was very lucky with this. I'd actually originally submitted a book to Anne Boleyn on Anne Boleyn, but it didn't fit their list. But I told the editor that I was toying with an idea of a book of ceremonies and events, a sort of Tudor hello or something like that. And it was because my friends, I've got a journalistic background, and my various friends would say, oh, we'd love to read proper history, but we don't want to read all the theories. And we don't want the conclusion. We don't want theories. We just want ceremonies and pageants and dresses and jewels and scandal.
And the fun stuff, right? That's the fun stuff.
So I've told the editor that I managed to meet up with, and we toed and froed, and we came up with The Tudor Socialite, which was actually their title. But as soon as they gave that to me, I loved it, and it helped me clarify what I needed to do, which was, of course, writing diary entries as if I was in the royal court. I wrote many of the entries like news stories or press releases, and that enabled me to give backstories if I couldn't fit them into the timing. So I used it as if it was happening in real time, but could also reveal what the backstory might be. So, yes, it was a lot of fun. And
that's such a helpful way for some people who, want to hear the history, just like you said your friends were saying, who want to hear the history but don't necessarily want to wade through some of the other pieces.
And that
this is a really great way to read through it.
And that was the other thing that the editor and I worked out, that we also wanted to make sure it was real history. It was a narrative that told people what happened as it happened without them feeling they were wading through a lot of stuff. And I know one of the reviewers who read the book didn't quite get that. He felt it was quite weird that it was done in the present tense. But I tried to make it so that I only ever knew what was going on at that time. no future.
Well, we're just going to ignore him. That's for sure.
So there was no forward thinking whatsoever. It was all, okay, I'm on this date now. What do I know behind that date?
Well, that's a very clever idea that you had. And thank you for doing that for the readers. Thank you for doing that for your friends. And I'm sure that you're quite proud of yourself to have done that. So where can we find the Tudor Socialite?
It's in, you can order it from Amberley, of course. And it's in every bookshop, as far as I'm aware. If you Google it, it just comes up, I'm told, by my friends. I was too scared to look at first.
Well, I have certainly Googled it myself, and yes, you can find it for sure, very easily.
In fact, when they first gave me the book, you get the advance book before it comes out, I was scared to look in case I opened it and found some great mistake that I'd made.
Oh my gosh! I'm sure it feels like a lot of pressure for you to finally put it out and let everyone get it in their hands. But it's a great book. It's a great topic, and I think that everyone is going to love it. So thank you.
Well, that's lovely.
Thank you again to our. Of course. Thank you again so much to our guest today, Jan Marie Knight, and to our listeners who wrote in with questions. We always couldn't do it without you. And of course, to everyone listening to this week's episode. As always, we appreciate your support and hope you'll tune in again next time as we continue to ask the experts the pressing questions you want answered. And if you love the Tudors Dynasty podcast and want to show even more support, please consider becoming a patron, where you'll not only receive the great content we offer now, but extra insider research, information, prizes, and other exciting opportunities only offered by subscribing. Until next time, thanks for listening.
And that concludes this episode of the Tudors Dynasty podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show, please show your support by leaving a review wherever you listen. Reviews are some of the greatest gifts that you can leave a podcaster because it suggests their show to people who may not have even known it existed. So thank you so much for your support.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tudors Dynasty podcast. You can follow and support the Tudors Dynasty podcast on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon @Tudors Dynasty.